Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays from now on until the next fun drive. One or two exceptions. With you, my friends, to bring you ideas, concepts, guests, authors, help you lead a more positively minded life. You know, a positive minded life is a life that has information, and it helps you stay a little more positive. You know, it's an attitude. Optimism is an attitude. Blind optimism, that's not an attitude so much. That's more just trying to keep things at bay. But optimism is an attitude, and keeping your hopes up is an attitude, and keeping your hopes up gets really stuck. You get really thwarted when it comes to love. You know, love and romance and relationships, that's where more people fall into depression and fall into, you know, feeling confused and get anxious about love itself. So, which is a funny thing, because why should love, which is the prize, right, be so painful? One would imagine, you know, if whoever designed this universe designed love in it as the ultimate prize, it would not be at the cost of pain, you know. Why would you have pain? I mean, flowers, you don't have pain. You know, they're beautiful. Music is not painful. Love is painful. What a funny thing. Well, one of the things, let's look at some of the aspects of love that make it painful, and maybe we could, by understanding it, make it more painful. No, make it deliberately painful? No, maybe get rid of some of the pain, or maybe understand the pain. You know, that's what I'm hoping we do. Need. Need, such a funny word, you know? Need. Sounds like something you did with your knee or something you do to bread. I need the bread. Need. N-E-E-D. Funny word, you know. I mean, some people don't think that there's love until they hear the word, I need you. Do you need me? Well, I love you, but I don't need you. Well, then you don't really love me. You gotta need me to love me. Right? Or, I need to be needed. Or, unless I need you, I don't really feel like I love you. So let's think about a love that doesn't have need involved. Hi, darling, how are you? I'm fine. Am I going to see you later today? No, it's okay. When will I see you next? Next year? Okay. Good. It'd be nice. I'm looking forward to when I see you again. I'll just hang out. I don't need you. It's one love, right? Imagine somebody who didn't need you, who claimed to love you. Well, it sounds like it's almost required, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound like need? Need in the dictionary, according to my researchers, which means they walked down the other side of the room and looked in the dictionary, is a lack of something required or desired. Need. Men and women need in different ways. So when you expect that I need you, therefore you need me, well, that doesn't necessarily work among all people, because we need each other differently. And in fact, one of the big confusions about love is that very often you love without differently. I can love you differently than you love me. Do you love each other differently? Well, let's see now. If I went away on vacation and I was away for a week, would you love me as my... See, people think that love should be a consensus. They are convinced that the way you love somebody has to be in agreement, that you do it exactly the same. I love you the way you love me. I desire you the way you desire me. I want to have sex with you. You want to have sex with me. I want to, you know, it's all supposed to be equal, this concept of equality. And it's a mistake, because people are different. Armand DeMille here with you at the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM, talking about love and need. So men and women are very different when it comes, people are very different when it comes to love. Everybody loves a little differently. So that's one item, but then not only does everybody love differently, there are specific things about ages, cultures, and the difference between the sexes. Men and women are needy in different ways. For example, men get obsessed before they land a partner. When women get obsessed after they find a partner. Isn't that a funny thing? It's like a man's on a hunt. You know, he's on the hunt and he's hunting. Obsession. The hunt is an obsession. Just like he's trained to do, go after the jiggle. In case you don't know what the jiggle is, the jiggle was what we discovered is that what one of the things that primitive man is most attracted to is a source that jiggles. If it's an animal that jiggles, that means it has more fat content, therefore it's more nutritious. So men tend to hunt things that jiggle. So they built the opposite sex with a built-in jiggle. Men get obsessed before they land a partner. They're on the hunt. And they could think about the person. They call you. They said, I found a strand of your hair in my bed this morning. And when I held it up to the sky, it glistened with sunlight. And I felt the warmth of you near me. Right? That's average man says that, doesn't he? Okay. Women get obsessed after they land a man. And land a man, I'm sorry for that expression, land a man means secure a relationship, you know? It's not that it's a trap, but it's like we try to secure a relationship with each other. We start right with the flirting. We're looking to see who's available, who's going to be there. It's at the beginning. We'll talk more about that later. Men and women alike become desperate for a guarantee of love. We look for these love guarantees. So once a man is, I'm talking about heterosexual relationships or any variation therein, because there could be one who's more masculine than the other. It could be any combination therein. But usually couples, each person in a couple is desperate for a guarantee of love. We look for love insurance. I think that's how marriage was invented, as love insurance. You know, desperate for a commitment. Here we make this commitment. It's like, you know, we imagine the Native Americans would cut their palms with a knife and they would clasp their hands and the blood would go into the other person's blood and you would be united in that way. Made a lot of sense to me. That was before we knew anything about genetics. You know, they were doing it. They were just saying, we are bonded. Tocayo is a Spanish expression. But men and women become desperate, and couples become desperate for guarantee of love. But that desperation, it kicks in at different points in a relationship for different people. I've seen neediness arrive even when men and women are not particularly care for the person they're needy about. In addition, the anguish associated with the need for love causes some people to get rid of love completely. It's just too painful for them. Did you ever meet them? And I've met people like that. Nope. Gave up on relationships. No more relationships. Uh-uh. And they get this kind of shape to their body. That's an interesting thing. They look like small tanks. It's not just weight gain, but it's weight that's distributed in a way almost to protect your heart. And you become blocky. You know, like you become kind of squarish, like SpongeBob. You know, you have this kind of square shape to you in some form. And I've seen people who are like this. They're thick. And it's almost like they've kind of said, you know, I am now not going to have relationships. I will socialize a little bit, but I am not going to have any love. Because why? Because the pain associated with the anguish is too much for me. I can't handle it. It makes sense. You know? It makes sense. If you were a junkie, if you were an addict, and you found yourself addicted to alcohol, right, and then you said you put it away and you said, that's it, the pain associated with my drinking and my addiction is such that I can't afford to have a slight drink. Well, we would understand that. If you were a heroin addict and you found that you know, the pain associated with heroin, getting it, finding it, spending the money, getting stoned, losing my life is so big that I can't go anywhere near it. Why can't people make that decision about love? Love has wrecked my life, many people would say. Therefore, I give it up. I give it up. I could have some casual sex. I could have, you know, sex with myself. I could have a relationship with myself. I can get a dog, a cat. Anything. I could depend on my family. I could join the church. I could do anything. But the one thing I'm not going to have is a one-to-one relationship because it is too risky and too painful. And I know many of you listening feel that way. Who blames you? You know, it's why. Why is it? It's because of the neediness. We're going to get to that. It's because of one of the little quirks of love, this need thing. Armand DeMille here with you with a positive mind. The notion that we live for love is a very old idea. We live for it, you know. It's some people just don't. They just give it up. But the writing on our genetic parchment is very old, and it says, be fruitful and multiply and agonize about keeping your mate along the way. That's the whole thing. Not only are we going to get love going, but we're going to have to keep each other. And that's where the desperation comes in. And that's what we're talking about today. Need and desperation is a part of love, which may be a required part of love. It just may be. You know, I don't know. Men and women have different unconscious reproductive motives. You know, in casual relationships, more women than men want to know where the relationship is going. And they keep focusing on the long-term potential. Because women have a lot more at stake reproductively. You know, they do. Women may take longer to get emotionally involved, but once they pass that threshold, once they get over the hump, after looking at you and thinking, you know, I'm not going to get involved with him. How could I get involved with him? I would not get involved with him. But once they go over that threshold, in general, they are in. In like a rock. That's it. I'm here. Anchor is here. Now I want guarantees. See, now I want to try to make this work. Now I'm going to make sure it works. Woman's vigilance is evident in the part of a woman's tendency to test her partner as the relationship begins, you know. They test, they act coy, they simply be, they don't trust. But once they get committed, they are obsessive, especially about keeping the relationship. They think about it, they work at it, they do the right things, they think about it. Men, by contrast, usually start off with this peak emotional investment because they have a lot to gain from, you know, the immediate reaction, positive reaction, which is they gain sex, which is like a biological mandate and imperative. 20 minutes of intense pleasure does not compare to the years spent raising children. A man's neediness stems from falling in love at first sight. Men are much more likely to agonize over how to get a woman than to keep her. Women agonize over how to keep their man or keep their mate. The less a man knows about a woman, the more alluring she is at first, and the more driven he is to interact with her. This is because men dream up the perfect woman. A bias that spurs them to chase, you know. Men idealization of women soothes the courting process. When it comes to seeking long-term relationships, men get obsessed with women who are barely within their reach because of their high payoffs. You know? I mean, they're looking for the best vehicle for their genes. So once they see it and it's out of reach, they've got to strain for it and yearn for it and reach for it. Usually women who are not too available don't engender that kind of neediness in men. But, it does. It could happen the other way. So what's in it? I mean, once they get there, once the behavior qualifies as needy, when a man suspects the relationship is going nowhere, but he can't stop. You know, because women generally lose interest in men who get clingy. And that's a problem. It's a problem now, you see. If a man, before he wins the woman over, shows too much need, then she turns off to him. She doesn't like that, generally. Generally, they don't like it because there's something desperate about it. There's something about it. She needs her time to get in there. And when the clingy one, you know, whenever you have two people in a relationship and one takes responsibility for all of the energy of it, like when a man is chasing a woman too strongly, you see some kind of just turn off. That's it. I've had enough of you. Even if they expressed interest in you in the first place, if you show too much desperation and too much neediness, the mate turns off. Both directions, by the way. In both directions. I mean, if a man goes out with somebody and then she keeps calling him and hounding him, boom, he just does away with it. He won't have any part of it. There's something about desperation that you don't want until you seal the deal, until you make your commitment, until you feel like you're really in it. So neediness, although it may be appealing for a man who may feel, for somebody who may feel inadequate, you know, if a man or a woman feels inadequate and they really find needy people very appealing, so they find needy people, like, you know, people who are attracted to drug addicts, alcohol addicts, they're the needy people. And you see them and you form relationships with them and they need you desperately and they need you. You could find that very appealing. If you're insecure, it makes you feel like a king or a queen. But if that relationship continues and it wants to go a deeper level, that need becomes a negative energy. It turns you away. There's a part of you that just rebels against it because you want to need also. You want to feel like you want to be there, not that you're obligingly there. You know what I mean? It's a very complicated thing, don't you think love is? I'm going to have to take some of your calls today. We're going to be taking your calls about this. Need is just difficult. How do you keep from falling into the neediness pit? Well, let's talk about the difference between men and women. Now, this is a very interesting concept because very often I think I'm talking about just heterosexual relationship, male versus female, but I've seen it differently. I'm going to now start at the beginning, starting grammar school. When you were in grammar school, well, how good a student were you? You think this is unrelated? It's not. It's going to go there, I promise. You were a certain kind of way in grammar school. Were you a bossy person? Were you a strong person? Were you interested in boys, interested in girls? What was your school like? Were you a straight-A student? Were you a failing student? Grammar school, right? And then how did you change when you went into high school? What were your grades like in high school? How were you doing? What was it like? Were you having fun, not having fun? Were you doing great? Were you getting weak in mathematics? All of a sudden, was science difficult? Was English difficult? Was music hard or difficult? Well, what they found, and it was kind of interesting, is that between the earlier grades, grammar school, and high school, of course, comes pubescence. Pubescence is when your sexuality emerges. And when it emerges, your hormones really take over. And the more testosterone you have, the more likely you're going to be a more aggressive person. See, and the more estrogen you have, the more likely you're going to be a receiving kind of person. For example, people high in estrogen frequently become caregivers. They become nurses, they become doctors, they become, you know, veterinarians. They become people who want to serve, and that's a high estrogenic kind of correlation. And, of course, it makes sense because nature would have built you to nurture, right? It builds the people with the most estrogen to nurture people. So the nurturing professions, social services, social work, you know, all that kind of stuff, I will say take care of you, I will feed you, I will take care of you, is more estrogenic in nature. Testosteronic, you know, going the other direction, the more male kind of aggressive stuff, more aggressive professions, you know, digging ditches, whatever you do, construction, automobile racing, stuff like that. It's more of the male kind of stuff. Now, that doesn't mean that women cannot be high testosterone, because very frequently women, as they go from grade school to high school, see the connection here? As they go from grade school to high school, they find in high school they become very testosteronic, that the testosterone, which is available in all women, can dominate, and they become pushy women, they become strong women, they become dominant women. And they go after things, and they hang out with the boys. Not because they're being girly, you know, they may be available, they may want to be a girl's side of it, but they hang out with the boys. Testosterone could be in the female high. And when testosterone is usually high among females, they're usually the leader of the pack. Usually you'll see they're the strong ones, they're the ones out in front. See, with the more estrogenic ones, the ones who are more female-female, following the male-female. So testosterone doesn't necessarily, is not reserved just for women, just as estrogen is not reserved for men. Because if you go to a social work school, estrogen is not reserved for women. There are men who become in the serving profession, like me. I'm in the serving profession, you know, and there are a lot of people who have high estrogenic, a lot of men, who have more sensitive sides. So it's not that testosterone means male and estrogen means female, but this is very important when it comes to this whole thing about desperation. Okay, and let me kind of explain it to you. If you're a man, or if you're high testosteronic, be wary of your desire to idealize your mate. Even an ex-mate, which very often happens, you know, you had a mate, the mate leaves, and then you see how wonderful they were. Testosteronic men, or males, and testosteronic women, get needy for acquisition and pursuit. That's their main thing, acquire and pursue. You're fantasizing about a perfect woman, that's okay. But if you want to get off that roller coaster of chronic disillusionment, remind yourself that your genetic legacy is to fool yourself before you're in and then pull away once the woman is off the pedestal. And that's what happens every time. You search, you search, you search, you hunt, you finally get the woman off the pedestal, and no, you're no longer interested. Now you kind of, it wanes. So what a man has to do, or somebody who's high in testosterone, or high as a high leader, a strong kind of aggressive person, what you got to do is watch out for those big hopes. Watch out for that desperation. Watch out for that part of you that is going to pursue at such a desperate level. If you're there, you can be guaranteed that relationship is probably going to fall apart. You cannot pursue with that kind of aggression. If you do, it's not going to turn into a long-term love relationship. It's going to turn into a need-based, anguishing relationship. And that's what happens when people come to see me. I'm helping them sort that through all the time. Dante may have been intoxicated with Beatrice his whole life, but it was from afar, you know. He loved her from afar. He never so much as kissed her. That makes for great poetry, but not great relating. But how many people do you know who love long-term relationships? There's on the internet, you get so many relationships nowadays where the man and the woman are nowhere near each other, but they are talking to each other on the internet. I located you, internet dating, and so on and so forth. And then you get together, and it's like, blah, it falls apart. It was the distance that made it attractive, that made the male pursue. Remember, men chase jiggle. They want to chase that which is not available and which is kind of running away or moving away. That's what they're looking for in general. Now, here's on the other side to those who are the hosts of the estrogen, whether you be women or men. Be cautious about your tendency to believe you need to make a relationship work at all costs. Forget it. Watch out for that need. You don't have to make it work, especially once you're in there. You know, it's okay to not feel desperate about making it work, because your need to make it work and your desperation at making it work very often can cause you the relationship, because your partner feels your desperation and moves away from it. You see, the thing that most men complain about is, I could never make her happy. These are the phrases that men use often enough, the divorced men, how they talk about their relationships. They say, I couldn't make her happy. Because the desperation of the partner who is on the other side of it, she's just saying over and over again, she's trying to make it work. So she's saying, we got to buy a house, we got to have a child, we got to have this, we got to do this, we got to make it work, we got to do sex therapy or something. That desperation very often will turn somebody off more than it will work to turn them on. You may not consciously want children, but the emotional engine that has evolved among women to be very cautious about sex and then to get very emotionally involved once they're in the relationship. That means you may have unwanted feelings of neediness only after a relationship has emerged. You can fight that idea that a particular fraught relationship must work out. And here's the idea. If you're in a relationship and you're somebody who's on that other side of it, right, you're on that woman's side of it, the serotonin side of it, the estrogen side of it, don't feel so desperate about making it work. It is the desperation that's a trick, because once the desperation goes in, it's the other side. You see, desperation itself can turn into an addiction. That whole thing, that whole yearning, that fire, that desire, I gotta make it work. You can just feel crazed. I know so many people who are crazed about their relationships. If only they would lay back, the relationship might begin to work. But if you're somebody who gets crazed, it becomes killer to a relationship. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. When we get back, we will be taking your calls at 212-209-2950, but we're not going to do that yet. We are talking about desperation in relationships, and we're talking about love itself and what happens to people in love when they become needy, and why does need appear only after a relationship is secured for women, whereas for men it seems to appear much more before. Why are men always pushing away after the relationship, while women are always pulling towards, you know, after the relationship? They're always trying to secure it. You know, it's very primitive. It's very primitive in a male. When he gets, you know, in most of nature, the male gets somebody in his crew. He gets a female, he just kind of assumes she's there, and he fights off the other men as they come around. But the female, once she's in there, she protects her turf a great deal. She makes sure that no other woman gets as close to him, no other female gets as close to him, and she's fighting the whole way. There's a desperation of the prime female, much more than there's a desperation about the prime male. And that's hormones. We'll talk more about that when we get back. WBAI 99.5. We'll take a short break. I'll give you a little music, and then we'll continue. DJ Crush, My Final Home. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Helen Fisher, an anthropologist, did some research using MRIs. Now, neuroscience is that new branch of science, not so new, but it's relatively new. That's why they call it neuroscience. neuroscience is the branch of science where they can now image the brain. You know, we can now look at pictures of the brain and we can find out things that are going on at different times. They use MRIs, and they use a thing called a functional MRI. And the earliest functional MRIs of brains in love were taken in 2000, and they reveal the sensation of romance is processed in three areas. The first is the ventral tegmental. Yeah, you know, ventral tegmental, this is the day, this is the day. I just can't stand somebody with a misshapen ventral tegmental. Because your ventral tegmental is a clump of tissue in the brain's lower region, which is the body's central refinery for dopamine. Do you get this? Without your ventral tegmental, dopamine doesn't get turned into fuel. You know, like they take oil and they have to put it to an oil refinery. Well, dopamine is like that. Dopamine in its raw form is useless. But if you take it and you drop it through the ventral tegmental, it kind of filters out into a useful form. It's the refinery. Dopamine does a lot of jobs, but the thing we notice most is that it regulates reward. When you win a hand of poker, it's a dopamine jolt that's responsible for the thrill that follows. If you hit the lottery, thrill that follows. You know, whoopee, that kind of feeling, dopamine. When you look forward to a big meal or expect a big raise, it's a steady flow of dopamine that makes the anticipation such a pleasure. Now, Helen Fisher and her friends, colleagues, conducted some recent MRI scans, who are people not just in love, but newly in love, and they found that their ventral tegmental areas are working particularly hard. Now, that's interesting, meaning there's a lot of dopamine activity. This little factory near the base of the brain is sending dopamine to the higher regions. It creates craving, motivation, goal-oriented behavior, and ecstasy. So don't ever put down the ventral tegmental. Where would you be without it? You'd be a lump of dopamine that's unuseful. Okay, now, even with its intoxicating supply of dopamine, the ventral tegmental couldn't do the love job on its own. Most people eventually do leave the poker table or the dinner table. Something has to turn the exhilaration of a new partner into what could approach an obsession, because that's the way love is. And that something is the brain's nucleus accumbens. I'm sorry. You just don't know it, but it's there. Your own nucleus accumbens is kind of hanging out somewhere around the ventral tegmental. And it's located slightly higher and further forward than the ventral tegmental, but you have the ventral tegmental and you have the nucleus accumbens. Why is this important? Accumbens. This is important because the thrill signals that start in the lower brain are processed in the nucleus accumbens via not only dopamine, but also serotonin. And they both together relate to oxytocin, which is the thing that makes you feel bound. Listen, my friends, if you didn't have any of these things, you don't know love is not spiritual. I mean, it may be spiritual, but gee, without your... Take out somebody's ventral tegmental, no love. Take out their nucleus accumbens, no love. Take out their dopamine, no love. Take out their serotonin, no love. Take out their oxytocin, no love. So if you remove all of these things from somebody, they have no love. I guess it must be essential. But of course, love kind of has a fever to it. There's a fervor. There's a thing that happens to it. But even if it's healthily shared, eventually the passion, the desire, it eventually breaks. And then you start to separate. Then you say, I don't want to get up that early in the morning. You know, then, I don't have the time. Oh, because it's unsustainable over time. Now, for Helen Fisher sees the danger of maladaptive love in her studies that she's conducting of these people who have just been rejected by a lover and can't shake the pain. And she fed in these subjects, as with all people in love, there is activity in the caudate nucleus, but it's specifically in a part that's adjacent to the brain associated with addiction. And here's what her claim is. Because she could see the activity in the two parts of the brain, the part that's the love part, you know, and the part that's the addiction part, she's what happens to her. She says the people who do not survive love relationships well and who can't get over love relationships are caught in an addictive cycle, and they're caught in an addiction. They should be treated not like a normal psychological. You should treat them as you would treat somebody with an addiction. How many people do you know that are addicted to a love or an ex-love? SLAA, you know, the Sex and Love Anonymous groups, you know, that's the way they treat it. They treat it like, this is an addict, this is an addiction. You are dealing with an addiction. Stay away from it. Don't keep playing the music. Don't keep, you know, smelling the tissues. Don't stay in touch with it. So, of course, so admonishing somebody that tries to avoid telling a jilted lover that it's time to move on, it doesn't work. It's like telling somebody telling somebody who's smoking a cigarette that they don't need those cigarettes. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work. You have to treat it as if it's an addiction. 212-209-2950. I could just talk about this all week, which I probably will. So stick with me and be sure to come back on Wednesday and Thursday. And, of course, if you wanted to hear this and you wanted to play this for somebody who you think might be helpful by this, you could always go to WBAI.org and the archives. In the archives of WBAI, they'll have the most recent program going back for quite a few weeks. If, however, that doesn't work, and sometimes it doesn't work, you can go to the other website, thepositivemind.com. And in thepositivemind.com, we have all our archives up there, and they stay up there for so far forever, you know, until we lose our dopamine or something, until our caudate nucleus breaks. 212-209-2950. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Our first one usually takes just a little work.
Hello?
Yes, there you are. Hi there. It's Armand DeMille.
Hi. My name's Sal, and I want to thank you for this incredibly incisive discussion. I have had difficulty throughout my life when I've broken up in relationships getting over it. Sometimes it's taken me years. And even now, I still tend to reflect on individuals that I have been involved with as though it was just yesterday. And it seems to be problematic in my life, and it at times it's affected me when I've gotten into new relationships. And when I did get into new relationships, if my feelings were intense enough, it was as though it simply replaced the intense feelings that I had for the previous person, and the cycle would begin again, where, as you had stated, regarding this kind of dishabituation with the person, and then you move on. But I've always seemed to have difficulty moving on.
Well, Sal, let me ask you a question. See if the theory holds true.
Yes.
Are you the kind of person who finds yourself most attracted to people who are not initially immediately available, but are a little stronger and a little more out of reach?
I do like the pursuit. Yes, like a prize.
Like the pursuit. Now, the person who you were, who the last one where your heart was broken.
Yes.
Think about that person. At first, when you tried to start this relationship, was it easy to come by or was it difficult?
Well, let me think. Actually, she was made herself very available to me. She was very available, and I really wasn't that interested in her. But after a period of time, the roles reversed.
She started becoming not available.
She became not available, then I became the pursuer.
Okay, so this is great proof to our story that when she was the pursuer and you weren't interested, but when she became this primitive part of you that says, in order for me to have it, I got to chase it, because if it's sitting right, I have a cat, and I have this silly cat. I mean, he's such a silly cat. I hate to tell him. I hope he's not listening, because I don't want him to think I think badly of him. He chases flies. And every now and then he chases a fly and he hits one. It would be one out of 1,000. He gets one and it falls to the ground at his feet. Now one would imagine, now he says, now I'll eat this fly. No. Because he only knows to chase flies. He doesn't know that once he catches them, he's supposed to eat them. And luckily those flies usually crawl away and just get out of his sight. And then he goes chase them again. So we have this kind of primitive instinct to chase, but not eat what's available. Okay, so now, what that says is, that sets up this combination of what we were talking about, of all the chemistry that we were talking about, that is just programmed for something that looks like addiction, and therefore, the end of the relationship is like losing the source of your addiction, and it's very hard to get over.
It's like withdrawal. Yes.
So the place, Sal, where you exercise your difference here is, you don't get over the last relationship by finding another person to pursue. Absolutely not. See what it's like, Sal, instead, to take somebody who's available and embrace them, and don't work so hard at the relationship. And I know you'll be a little bored. You know what I mean? But see what it's like, just so you could change the chemistry. Because when somebody's offering you love, and you turn it down, and you only want a love that's not available, that sets up the cycle for the relationship you can't recover from.
Or that's problematic, or that seems to be concomitant with some degree of pain or rejection or it's most of the time that I'm most, if I'm not in a drama type situation, I tend to create some type of drama or be with someone who has a tendency to create drama.
Isn't that great? Yes, you find somebody, drama becomes such an important part of the relationship. You know, the old monks used to wear hair shirts. Mm. You know what a hair shirt is?
No, what's that?
Monks used to put on these shirts that were made of animal hair that was so painful to have on your body, it rubbed you raw every minute. Mm. And they did this as an act of worship. They figured with this they could love God more. And so they would wear these hair shirts as a dedication to God. In a way, that's what you're saying. I need a hair shirt to really love.
It's masochistic, isn't it?
Well, you know, that's a judgment.
Okay.
If we associate the two, I mean, it's really very primal. And, you know, I just see it as the kind of a, some people get stuck in it and other people don't. But you got to take the, got to remove all the judgments because sadistic and masochistic really suggests that there's something absolutely pathological about it. And the truth is, loving without searching for and hunting for and following the hunt is an evolutionary stage.
Mm.
You know, you're trying to evolve. You're trying to just get beyond the biological mandate, trying to get beyond that which nature gave you to do, and it said chase the jiggle.
Well, thank you so much. Well, before you go, I want to thank you. What is the name of that book by Helen Fisher again?
Well, I don't know Helen Fisher's book, but just look up Helen Fisher. She's got many books. She's an anthropologist. Just see what she's done latest. You'll find it on the Internet. We're going to get her on the air. Did we have her on the air already? No, we're going to get her on the air soon. I've had some contact with her.
Thank you so much, Armand. You're great as always.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Right. 212-209-2900 is the number here. Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hi there, Armand.
Yes.
This is not a question or anything, but I just want to tell you about a book that's out of print, came out of Yale, or somebody from Yale wrote this thing 20 years ago. It was called Limerence. Does that name ring a bell with you?
Sure.
And it was about this guy had all these students, and most people, myself included, you know, you hear a love song or something, and you get affected by it, and you feel it. He found that some certain small percentage of people at Yale didn't know what we were talking about when someone said, I'm in love, or whatever. They just didn't have those feelings. And I lent my book to somebody, and they lost it, so I lost it for 15 years now, but maybe you could talk a bit about that, because mentioned something like that in the second previous call. You mentioned, was that person getting hard to get? And that was part of it, too, that you went after people who were impossible to get.
Well, you know, on being limerent is an actually, it's a condition. There was a psychologist, I remember, Dorothy Tennov, T-E-N-N-O-V, who wrote the book, and in an attempt to, she wrote the book, and the meaning of the word, which was coined in 1977, was an involuntary cognitive and emotional state in which a person feels an intense romantic desire for another person, and she called that the word the limerence object.
But they had no feeling for these songs and so forth, zero.
That's right, the non-limerence, right? The limerence.
Well, whatever, I forget which positive or negative.
Yeah, the limerent people are the people who are falling in love.
Okay.
And it's kind of an interesting book, but you're right, Tennov, T-E-N-N-O-V. However, if you look on the Internet, under the word limerence, you will find, I think Wikipedia does a pretty good extensive coverage of it that we once took and did a reporting on for that very reason. In fact, we had the author. I think we had Dorothy Tennov on the air.
How do you spell that last name?
A T-E-N-N-O-V.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling in, and thanks for reminding us.
Bye-bye.
Yep. She said from distinction from love, Tennov, I remember, said, love involves concern for the other person's welfare and feeling, while limerence doesn't involve it, it can certainly be incorporated, but it's not based on consideration of the other person. You know, when you're limerent, you just love the other person, and if they don't feel good, the hell with it. And affection and tenderness exist only as a disposition towards another person. It's irrespective of whether these feelings are reciprocated. See? That makes you limerent. And then physical contact, it's not essential if you're limerent, because it's not essential nor sufficient, because it's like you could live without it. It's a state of mind. And limerence can be longer lived than transient forms of romantic feelings such as infatuation and puppy love. It could endure for months or even years in the absence of knowledge about reciprocity. If the other person is not knowing you're doing it, you could really feel this tremendous love for that non-available person. A little different than what we were talking about, because what we were talking about was people who feel this tremendous love for somebody who is available, although not available. You know, they're a little bit out of range. It's a little bit out of sight. It's like a tempting, you can almost get there if you want, but you just got to try harder. Those relationships, if you find yourself going for those relationships where you have to yearn very hard to get it to work, or yearn to keep it together, and you got to struggle very hard to get it together, you're caught in a trap. That's not going to make love work. Love does not require intense struggle. It requires some consideration, some exchange, some adjustments, but the intense struggle, oh my gosh almighty, that's usually not something that results in great love, and it doesn't require great love to achieve, you know? Hey, so I'm going to be going. If you want a copy of today's program, you could go to WBAI.org or thepositivemind.com. I will be back with you. And I'm looking for volunteers for a project. It just requires administrative project. You can go through my website and get in touch with us if there are any volunteers who do administration. Hey, back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. This is Armand Mill, a little more music. Be back with you soon.